Welcome to the Fargo Podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Fargo on FX. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 2, Episode 2, entitled Before the Law. What did you think of this episode, Aaron?
This show kind of continues to blow me away. I was amazed at the amount of drama that they were able to get out of situations where, rationally, I knew there was nothing that was going to happen.
All right.
You know.
Because it's too early? Because like, it's like... Like with Jesse Plemons and Lou
rolls in on Jesse Plemons with fingers rolling everywhere and heads in the windows and stuff. There's palpable tension. I don't give a shit about fat Jesse Plemons. And I know Lou survives this season.
Sure, yes. And it's too early to slap the cuffs on Ed, right?
Right, right.
Yeah.
But you're right. There's the whole so time much I'm just like, oh my God. And then when you throw in a situation like where there actually is stakes, like Ted Danson, you know, pulling over Mike or setting up their Mike roadblock.
That's the thing, right?
I would fully believe the sheriff, Larson, could die this episode because the old sheriff died in, like, the first fucking episode.
And they killed off Kieran Culkin already in the first episode. So, yeah, I'm thinking anybody but Lou can die here, right?
I felt like Sheriff Larson felt like he could die. I mean, I think that's what separates this show from a good show is, like, the show of Larson walking back to his car and him being genuinely rattled. Yeah. Like, we kind of got that a little bit with his okay, but seeing him kind of like blow out a ragged breath and gather himself once he finally could not be brave, you know, he could start to piss his pants a little bit. I don't know, man. I think this show is great. And just some of the shots have no right to be as pretty as they are.
I'm thinking the cinematography is great.
When the when Bear's son goes into Uncle Dodd and he's torturing that guy.
Mm-hmm.
And that scene is just lit so amazingly in the barn. And then in the whole backdrop is that gate with the slats and the lights pouring through it. And you got these animals looking around like it's the baby Jesus in a manger.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they're cutting off a man's ears. I don't know. This show is just oozes quality.
I agree. I'm thoroughly enjoying it. I mean, we're probably going to talk a lot about what we like about this. I want to talk up front just real quick about something that I didn't totally dislike, but just kind of bugged me a little bit. And I just didn't care for it in the episode. And it's this search for Rye, right? We know Rye's dead. I just felt like
you're right.
The scenes where they were talking about we need to find Rye and like setting everybody up. I get what they're doing. They're setting up confrontation between these different factions that are all looking for Rye. Gotcha. Makes sense. The police, Kansas City, Gerhardt's, everybody's looking for Rye. But I didn't care to see the scenes where they were talking about let's find Rye because it felt to me like they drug on.
All right. Well, I got a couple of responses.
Okay.
Even if I grant your premise.
Mm-hmm.
A devil's advocate position would be this is essentially the Martian dust storm. Like that, you know, we talk about the movie The Martian and it begins with this dust storm that causes a bunch of havoc.
Yeah, yeah.
And you come to find out that that's physically impossible to happen on Mars.
Okay.
But if you sit down and rack your brain, how could you? The rest of the movie is so good. You need an engine to start that up. You need like a pull start lawnmower. You got to jump start that thing.
Sure.
Do you swallow the giant scientific inaccuracy and blunder of the premise just so you can get the rest of the oh so good sciencing the shit out of things?
Yeah.
I guess I do.
I'm saying that this hunt for
Rye is a way to bring these unrelated parties into collision later on. So I kind of am willing to accept it on that. But also, to the extent that I care about what's going on with Ed and Peggy, it's this storm cloud that, I mean, they're already doing an immoral, illegal act.
Yeah,
but they think this is just some like I'm assuming they don't know who the Gerhardts are.
Probably not. Yeah,
which I don't know if I buy that if they're the local big bads. But then again, we're dealing in two. I haven't quite got the geography.
Like his boss might know.
Maybe, who the Gerhardts are. Also he was a ways away out of his way.
Yeah,
you know, like there's stuff taking place in Wisconsin. There's stuff taking place in North Dakota. This judge is from North Dakota. I don't think she was in Wisconsin. So he's well out of his kind of like backyard territory.
Yeah.
But they already are doing this wicked thing. And they don't even know that like not only did you run over some dude and you concealed it and you're grinding up his body, but also he was the son of an important crime. Like, you just killed Sonny. Well, Fredo. You just killed Fredo Corleone.
Yeah.
Not only did you just kill a dude, and that's bad, but you also killed the Godfather's son. That's even worse.
Sure.
And
sure.
That I get it. Constant I, reminder all those things make of sense. Everyone's looking for Rye. And there's one more thing. One more leg to my counterpart to your argument.
I don't have an argument here. Let's make that very clear. I just don't care for it personally. It made these scenes drag.
I also think that Rye, I'm trying to figure out what Rye's importance is, because it seems that they're hinting that Rye was more important than we were led to believe. Like, his brother makes some statements about, like, I can get the distributors to go along, but
yeah,
it would be more help. It'd be a lot easier if we had Rye. Like, maybe Rye is, you know, Bear is a terrifying, hard to relate to man.
Sure.
Dodd is kind of a bit more of a dandy, but he still is this severe, scary person. Maybe Rye's to every man that had the gift of gab. He's like the Better Call Saul part of the family that smoothed out all the day-to-day relations with the blue-collar guys. I don't know.
Yeah, what it felt like to me is they were setting up... So the,
like, Rye's
the
super
mom,
popular with the rank-and-file dudes, maybe.
I think so, yeah. There's something about Rye's relationship with this business that makes it work.
And also...
And the mom
yes.
is being set up as the counterpart, right? There needs to be that person on both sides of this family
yes.
war.
Like, Rye
and
was
I think the mom has a piece of that.
Sure.
Rye had a piece of that. And without Rye, he's not going to be able to control the business if he decides to take out mom. You know?
Yeah, like Rye maybe had the lower operations, like, on friendly basis, and mom has, it seems like, all the really important upper-level connections.
Yeah, yeah.
Which puts Dodd in a very uncomfortable position of being the man in the middle.
Sure.
And also...
And without a leg to stand on, because Rye's dead.
Yeah, right. And two episodes in, he just seems so dumb. Like, not dumb, like, duh, dumb, but going against his mother seems like a really stupid thing to do, just seeing these two interact.
Particularly at this moment, yeah.
And how everyone is underestimating the mom,
mm-hmm.
that would be a useful thing to exploit, because their mom seems formidable.
Oh, yeah, totally. The impression I get of her is very much like, I've kind of been helping run this business in the background anyway, and it's such a natural progression for me to just step in and... Not a beat will be missed here.
No,
we'll just continue on exactly how we were before.
I get real Mags Bennett vibes from her.
Yeah.
Which is incredibly high praise. If you never saw Justified,
sure.
Mags Bennett was the best thing to ever happen on the show.
Uh-huh.
So I am excited. It seems like that we're heading toward a tragedy where this family empire that was built from a shoeshine box is going to be taken down by... A doofus in a leather jacket and a cab driver's hat.
Wait, is that the lawman here, or is that... No, seriously, there are two factions, right? Like, you got the KC guys, and then you got the law as well.
And the other thing I thought was interesting is when I came into this episode and I saw the meeting at the Gerhardts, and, you know, everybody filing past each other and kind of mean mugging, I got the instinct impression with Mike and whoever Ray Romano's brother is.
Joe Bulow.
Like, you guys are really underestimating these Gerhardts. Like,
yeah.
This you're going to walk right into a shit show. This is going to be essentially the plot of a Snatch, where the pig farmer just completely discounts the Pikeys and suffers mightily for it. By the end of the episode, I'm thinking, I don't know, man. Maybe Mike is right to be this cocky as shit, because he seems smart as hell,
mm-hmm.
super dangerous, super calculating, you know, rightfully aware of his place in the world and where he fits into it.
Oh, yeah. The Kansas City guys seem formidable, for sure. But I don't know that the Gerhardts aren't. You know,
I know,
we haven't seen enough of them to really
know yet.
But their
house divided is the problem.
That is the big problem.
The fact that, like, if they all, I feel like right now, if they all threw in behind the mom,
yeah,
game over. Kansas, it's going to be a tough match, but Kansas City is going to get beat decisively. With this division, it seems a foregone conclusion that Kansas City is going to mop them up. I mean, again, we're just two episodes in, but.
Who are you rooting for here? Dodd or the mom?
The mom, because I feel like she is the smart one, and I tend to naturally go in with the smart one over the bravado.
Over the tough one. Sure, I'm with you. I think
like for example, I think Dodd, like if we're gonna take the conclusion to its natural, you know, the Godfather analogy, like Dodd is Sonny.
Yeah. He's gonna beat someone in the streets, and the mom, and it's all gonna come back on him. And
the mom is either the Godfather or she's Michael.
Either way.
Either way. Odds. Yeah. Or maybe she's both and Sonny's super fucked.
Yeah.
But I don't know where Bear, like, I thought even Bear seems smarter than Dodd, which I did not get immediately. I mean, when he's like, oh, you think it should be? He's like, no, stupid. It should be mom. I'm like, yes. Yes.
He's drinking his half and half.
The caveman drinking cream right out of the udder knows more about the world than you do, Dodd.
Yeah. Well, it strikes me as Dodd being kind of, this is the moment he's been waiting for, right? Like,
yes.
This isn't necessarily
his old
a
man's
tragedy
not
for
getting
him.
Any younger, and yeah. He's been doing the day in and day out, and kind of been
and he's
the enforcer.
Not getting any younger too. I mean, I don't. He's not old. He maybe 40, if that.
Yeah.
He looks fairly young still, but I don't know
he
how
feels
much
like
I
he's
believe.
Ready. He feels, yeah.
Yeah, of course he feels like he's ready. If he was 19, he would feel like he's ready, right?
Yeah. And I think
that's
also
how it works.
Like, I thought, so what did you think about this? When his mom was making him eat the pretzel roll or whatever the fuck that
which
thing was.
She just cooks in bulk. Like, she's baking bread all the time. It must sure. be. She's got shelves of it.
But she's making him, and I thought she just had unquestionable moral authority. I'm like, you know, when she's telling this guy to eat and telling him to sit down and like putting him into the little boy corner. And they had that jostling over who's going to sit at the head of the table.
See, I thought that might annoy you, this passive-aggressive sit-at-the-head-of-the-table bullshit.
No, I thought it was...
Because you don't like that passive-aggressive stuff.
I thought it was funny. And then he's like, whoa, okay, I'm going to sit at the foot of the table. Now it's the head. Boom.
Exactly, yeah.
I thought that was pretty good. And I actually...
And it creates this space between them, too, visually, right?
Yes.
Thematically, it works really well.
I actually thought that he was going to listen to reason. But then she said, I think where he decided, fuck you, was when she said, I will hand you your legacy or something along those lines. Like,
he wants to take it.
Yeah. He doesn't want to be handed or to be that kind of backed up his pride. I think she almost carried the day, but I think she was trying to be reassuring and like, look, I don't really want this family. I want to get
I'm
this.
I'm not certain I believe her. I'm not 100% on that. Like, I don't know if she steps down as soon as this crisis is over. Or when does the crisis end, right? Like, how long is there going to be a crisis that requires her attention?
You're right. I believed her, but I don't know why I did. I mean, if I'm completely honest, it's probably for subconscious sexist reasons of that I just assume she's an old woman and she's got...
Mom's not going to lie to you.
Yeah, when she's got pizza, she's got pretzel bread to bake and, that's you know, true. Cheese and all these other... domestic things, and yeah, so you're right. I got hornswoggled by my own
maybe so
my own biases.
I don't know. I didn't totally believe her there.
Huh.
Power has a way of corrupting.
Sure. Sure.
And she gets a taste of that and she might not want to let go of it.
Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, maybe that was kind of her relationship with her with the you know, Colonel Ty.
Yeah.
Is that he was the hothead impetuous, because it seemed like that's where he was going when he had a stroke.
I think so,
and she was the one who was always like, yes, we need to defeat these people, but we can't, you know, we need to be smart about it and build consensus and all those other things. It's the family dynamic is fascinating, and also, I don't know why, but I also think it's fascinating when you see obviously rich and powerful people living like pioneers on the homestead.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like they're not dressing flashy. Their house is not, you know, okay, but kind of ran down and ramshackle, and they're still doing farming and shit. Like
sure.
Amish mafia type stuff. I don't know why, but I think that is fascinating. Not to show Amish mafia, that's bullshit, but that kind of feel.
Yeah, I get it. I get you.
Even like, say, it's the same The Godfather. I guess he had that big, what did they call it, the mall or the plaza? But it was fairly modest for what he was capable of.
Yeah, probably.
And then maybe that was one of the problems with, if we want to turn this into Godfather cast, that was one of the problems with Michael. He wanted to move out and get the big lakeside mansion and be flashy. And
sure, he did it upright.
Yeah. But I mean, so to some extent, it's like she's talking about this empire and all that stuff. It's like, why do you build... Why would you build an empire and then hide it from the world? I mean, that's a smart criminal thing to do, but at some point, I've always been fascinated by guys like Walter White and, you know, the Gerhardts, where they're essentially a piling wealth and power, but for no, because like they can live their lifestyle probably just having a farm in Wisconsin, that size farm. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I mean, there's something to be said for just having something like that, right? Even if, I mean, a lot of people have wealth and power and don't need to show it off, and I feel like that's who these people are.
Do you think some people are just born with giant chips on their shoulder, and that drives them in a way that I just can't understand?
Well, I mean, I guess it's the difference between proving it to yourself and proving it to someone else.
But how often do you have to prove
that? You can be self-assured.
You know, like, before it's like, do you not have any other passions? Do you not want to travel? Do you not want to, you know... Sure. Start racing cars or what? I mean, whatever it is, like bear. Don't you gonna want to go become a champion axe thrower? Or
yeah,
Dodd, I mean, don't you want to start your career as professional Jim Carrey impersonator?
Well, some people are singularly focused like that, right? Like they build something, they want to continue to build that.
Those
thing
are the Steve Jobs of the world, and that's why.
Exactly. Yeah,
I'm plugging a white bald move.
They don't want to be world's best archer. They don't want to be log roll competition guy.
Yeah,
they just want to build their criminal empire. And there's something that I envy about that. There's something that I find depressing about that. I mean, it's different strokes for different folks, you know.
Since we're talking about Bear here a little bit, we met his son, and he's got some physical disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say Bear is the like most strapping physical specimen of the family.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't even comment on this except for Mike was given this analogy about the brothers being two different lobster claws.
Yeah.
Like, one is the crushing claw and one's the pincher claw, which I thought was kind of interesting. And in relation to the guy's kind of like flipper hand or whatever, what's going on there?
Is his hand CG in this? I don't think he's really got problems with his hand, right?
I don't know. It's hard to tell. Like, after I saw
it, looked like some scenes they really fucked with his fingers and other scenes they didn't.
I mean, it could. Like, I saw American Horror Story Freak Show last year, and it's kind of hard to tell the legitimate freaks from the manufactured ones, to be honest.
I'm not calling him a freak, but no, well, I get what you're saying.
Yes. I'm only using context of more American Horror Story.
Okay. I just wanted to give you an opportunity to say that.
Carnival performers.
But I don't know. I'm the lobster claw thing was very much like which one has the power, right?
Yeah, I just thought it was interesting the emphasis they put on the dude's hands opening the letters and all that, and then making that kind of analogy. I don't know what it means. He seems like he's giving very bullshit roles in the family. Like, he hasn't done anything.
He's the letter opener. Come on.
But he knows that his uncle's torturing dudes in the barn too.
Yeah.
So I wonder what they're going to do with kind of the mama's boy. Or is he going to be key to the season somehow? And the family struggle?
I don't know.
He's going to have to make an important decision about who to shoot and who not to shoot at some point?
Maybe. I don't know. Too early to say, I think.
Okay.
How about this? The guy playing Mike. Mike. What's his name? What's his last name?
I have no idea. He's Mike.
Milligan or something like that. He's doing a killer Dave Chappelle doing a white guy voice.
So
that's all I can think when I hear his voice.
I think he's doing a killer Dave Chappelle guesting on Key and Peele doing a black Republican skit voice is what I think. Cause it's
that's
a subtle like,
level deep.
There's something Dave always puts a little lame or weak into the white guy impersonation. I think that's kind of like black guys be like this and white guys be like this. And there's none of that. Like, this guy is not soft at all.
No, he's scary.
So he's got that kind of slightly square edge, and he's, like, politically involved and talking about this great country.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he would vote for Ronald Reagan. So that's why I guess I'm going with the black Republican. But, yeah, no, there is a lot of... Like, if Dave...
I haven't seen that skit, so I don't know what you're talking about.
Damn it, if I'd known that, we should have watched it. But... I think that, like, you see those commercials where, I forget who is, Chris Paul. he's a plays basketball, and he's like good, a really good point guard. And there's a State Farm version, like they're separated at birth. And like Chris Paul, the basketball player, played basketball, but then his other brother became an insurance agent. Looks just like him,
okay,
but he wears like a cardigan and glasses and all that. I feel like that's the Dave Chappelle thing. Like this is Dave Chappelle's brother who pursued a serious acting career because they've got similar amounts of charisma and even comic timing. Because Mike is also funny. He's really funny, but he's also completely menacing as well.
Oh, yeah.
But... that's...
Yeah, some of the best scenes in this episode were with him. I thought when he went into the typewriter store, that was awesome. And when he, you know, squares up with Ted Danson, that was awesome as well.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to a lot more of this guy, frankly.
While we're talking about seafood-based parables.
All right.
You know, we had the lobster claw analogy. What about the oyster?
Ripping the roof off your house and eating you.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Are we going to have a clam? Are we going to have a clam-nado? That tears the roof off of Sheriff Larson's house and sucks him right out.
It's going to be the aliens. They're going to tear the roof off and it's going to
look exactly like their ship's going to look exactly like an oyster shell.
There you go.
And it's going to rip the roof off and just slurp him right up.
Yep. And probe him for weeks. I don't know, man. Here's the thing.
They are absolutely going for the alien shit this year.
Oh, yeah. The last shot of this.
Like, if you didn't know, that is that's the first chapter of War of the Worlds, the classic H.G. Wells and later.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what order we want to talk about this stuff in, but the voiceover at the very end is a voiceover from this album by Jeff Wayne, I guess, called Jeff Wayne's Musical Version of War of the Worlds. And the song is called Eve of War.
And oh, I didn't know that. I thought it was just some dude reading the book because that's a direct quote from the book, too.
It is, but that specific track, like that music that comes after like the track starts that way with the quote and then it goes into that song. So, like, you get the impression from that, we are definitely on the eve of war, right? Both between Kansas City and the Gerhardts themselves.
Yeah, so it works on that level.
And the law in Kansas City and the Gerhardts and the law, like, everybody's on the eve of war here.
Sure.
But then it also works with the shot that they have where it pulls back and it pans up and you kind of see reflections in the glass of these blue lights, a lot like Rye saw in the first episode.
Yeah.
And it really establishes that otherworldly something is going on here feel.
Plus they have the Mylar balloon that Molly found that's kind of like, oh, swamp gas reflected off a weather balloon. Did you get any of that? Because that's the first thing I thought kind of... lens flared off, and I'm like, oh, well, wasn't Rye super high on something when he killed the judge?
Bug spray? Maybe.
But I thought he, like, snorted something, or am I getting my...
No, he did.
Okay, because
right
I'm like...
he went in there.
We just watched that episode of Breaking Bad where Jesse tries to take a half measure, and sometimes that stuff gets confused. But I'm like, maybe the aliens were just a figment of his imagination. But then I'd like to direct your attention to the Bald Move Monitor. Do you notice what's on in the television behind Ted Danson as he's reading the paper at the breakfast table?
It says Mars rotating around a planet that looks like Mars.
Yeah, and then you have the War of the Worlds quote. So you're right, this War of the Worlds could be Kansas City coming, like, casting envious eyes to North Dakota and wanting to take it over. But there's also a lot of fucking direct references to aliens. Like
the
alien in the garage.
Direct.
Yeah.
Yeah. You see a UFO in the first episode
and
fly off.
And the fact that I did not know this, but this is part of the Coen's visual dictionary. They do have alien abduction stuff in their films. And
I wasn't aware of that either.
Yeah. So that's my objective this weekend. I want to see The Man Who Wasn't There and also Miller's Crossing. Because then I've seen all of the stuff. And coincidentally, those are the most important, according to Noah.
Yeah, yeah.
Holly, that's the most important references to Coen's. So, fuck my life. I'm trying to podcast on Fargo and not seeing the only two Coen brothers movies that are the references for this. But no, this alien stuff has got some kind of legs. And to be honest, it wouldn't disappoint me if it's a complete Mylar balloon, swamp gas reflection kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't disappoint me to have actual no shit aliens in Fargo. Also, let me tell you something I found on Reddit. Apparently, there is a incident in 1979 where a Minnesota sheriff's car was hit by a UFO. Like, this is a famous case in the UFO culture.
I mean, couldn't they identify it after it was hit, or did the thing disappear? Did.
So what the sheriff said, he was driving down a road, and this bright light appeared like a mile and a half down the road and instantly overtook him and shined this light, and he felt completely powerless and helpless. And
this sounds like a guy who was drunk on duty one night, crashed his car, and made up a story about
So I guess there's something oddly specific about the damage, but the thing that's really interesting is that both his wristwatch and the squad car, which they set the squad's radio, which is synchronized to the police station's time, were both exactly 14 minutes slow.
Okay. And found to be otherwise. Right?
Yeah, 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 yeah. 18 hours. Exactly. Jodie Foster happened to be driving a car. But, look, I'm not saying that this guy got hit by a UFO. I'm just saying that this is something out in the culture that happened in the 70s Minnesota, and it would not surprise me at all if something hinges on, and this time I'm ready for it. I'm braced for the fishnado. I'm just like, you know, big wave in the ocean. I'm just going to like just take it right on the chest.
But this might be okay because, I mean, you know, the idea of sufficiently advanced technology being indistinguishable from magic. I mean, there are so many things that an alien technology could do that if they say, hey, this is alien tech, as opposed to this is something that happens in nature on Earth and it's such a coincidence at this point.
Plus, to be honest, if you found out there's a little gray man driving around this Ed suit, it wouldn't shock you, right? Like,
I mean,
Man in Black style. When he's standing there
in black,
when he's standing there in a fire, like in the fireplace in all of his glory, in his striped socks, if his face had slid open and there's a little tiny man steering it, I would have been like, sure, why not?
Yeah.
Because he looks and acts kind of alien.
A little bit.
This is the point of the podcast where I take back everything bad I said about Jesse Plemons in the last 2 weeks.
I was going to ask you about that because, man, the performance he delivers.
The nuance in his face that he was displaying when he was confronting the bloody car. And it doesn't help that you had the music behind it, but maybe he needed all these roles of playing dopey dudes to get the reps to where he could play this particular dopey dude. Uh-huh. But I am really enjoying what Jesse Plemons is bringing to the Ed table.
Yeah.
Which and is about scene... 50 pounds of ham. I mean,
he's got double dad bod here, right? He's got the dad bod of two men.
Yeah. Like a dad ate another dad. Uh-huh. That's the bod you'd get. But he's incredible.
And just the visual of his... I don't know, him in his underwear and his socks. And
like, I feel like in watching his performance for 30 seconds, I'm seeing a slightly less than intelligent, average intelligence person wrestle with a weighty moral issue and the love he has for this wife, and does she really love me, and is this all a lie that I'm it's incredible. It's incredible, and I don't know a lot of actors that could pull something like that off.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm sorry, Jesse Plemons. You are the man. You keep playing these roles because they're needed.
So let's talk a little bit more about this scene, because when he's standing there, it pans down into the fire and we see something that clearly isn't going to burn. And I think that's potentially the belt buckle of Rye.
Yes. That's what I got too.
Could that very come back to haunt him?
Very Game of Thronesy. Too.
Yeah.
Seeing that wolf head butt or whatever the fuck it was burning. I thought I was going to see old Lannister throwing Ned's sword to fire or something like that.
Yeah. So that thing's not going to burn. It's going to stay there. Is there any chance that comes back on?
Which smells worse when you throw it on a fire? A wolf pelt, 500 year old sword scabbard, or Jesse Plemons underwear?
Jesse Plemons underwear.
Okay. I mean, wasn't sure.
That's a man who's just been hunched over in a garage for hours cleaning up blood. There's
going to
be
moist.
Sweat. There's going to be grunge.
Maybe the hygiene's not the best because it's wintertime and nobody showers every day when you're in North Dakota wintertime.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, large men have a tendency to gather crud anyway.
Do they?
So.
Do we?
I assume so.
That's your sizes, Jim.
Maybe so. But I can't imagine that underwear is all that healthy at that point.
All right. Other than the wolf pelt debate, what were you going to say?
Does that belt buckle come back on him?
It's hard.
What I thought was that the shoe that what's his face found, that Ted Danson found, had some kind of ornament on it, and this was the other one. Mm. But I really think it's the belt buckle.
I think it's the belt buckle. And it seems hard to believe that it won't. But on the other hand, it's in the back of the fire grate, and who is
how
going?
How could it? Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, this is 1970 something, 79, I guess.
Yeah.
That makes the sheriff UFO incident extremely relevant. But you know, Todd seemed like he did a pretty good job cleaning up the crime scene. I don't know what he's going to do about the window. And he seemed like he dodged the main bullet of body disposal. Like, I don't know what he does with 160 pounds of whatever McCulkey meat.
Sausage.
McCullen meat. But
ground beef. Ground Culkin.
Yeah, ground Culkin. I don't know what he's going to do with all that, but I assume that this is kind of going to be a situation like... But who knows? Because there's thing with Fargo. Like, I didn't see how Lester was going to get out of his little predicament. And then he framed his brother, and the rest is history. So it's really hard and almost kind of pissing up a rope to try to guess where they're going to go with this show. But I agree. I can't see how it's going to be a connection, but it's got to be.
Yeah. So in the first season, that hammer comes back, but it's because that is a crime scene, right? Like, that basement is being actively investigated. Whereas I don't know how his house would ever be investigated. Unless the car window leads back
to the
house. That's
the thing.
Like,
how are they going to get the car window fixed?
I don't know.
If they go to a garage and be like, I guess you got to get hit by a deer or something. Or...
But then they're all telling conflicting stories, and this is a problem.
You know, that's another great Fargo element of these novice people committing big, big crimes. And kind of doing a lot of things smart, but you just...
They need to have a powwow. Sit down, say, what story are we going to tell about what happened here?
Yeah.
Because they have been telling different stories. Not to leave Jesse Plemons, let's go over to the scene at the end with Lou, where he's making the sausage. This is a grisly. This is a horrible, horrible thing that's happening here. Uh-huh. But I love it. I absolutely loved every second of this scene, from him grinding up rye to Lou showing up.
So as I was watching him do that, and this is something I don't notice on the first time through, but like the third time when I'm just kind of background watching this with my notes.
Yeah.
I looked up and I noticed, like, Ed muscling in this leg and grinding it. And I'm like,
yep,
these arms and legs look surprisingly beefy coming from Rye. And okay. I just assumed they'd just take body cast of his arms and legs and there you go. But do you think he just got stock legs? Or because...
Yeah, maybe.
This looked like a much more strapping man than
kind of got thick, meaty hands a little bit.
Maybe he's just got club feet. Like
maybe so.
Big doughy honking feet and hands.
I mean, those shoes were pretty big, right?
Were they?
It seemed like. Well, I mean, they're super pointy, so who knows how.
I thought
far
I actually saw that
in.
Size was a size 10.
Oh, it is?
When Ted Danson was kind
Mike
of rotating
around.
Yeah, which I thought was a little interesting.
Oh. So that might point him in the wrong direction.
Yes. That's where I'm seeing is that there's going to be, in the next few weeks, we're going to see a lot of people acting on good information and drawing the wrong conclusions from them.
How good is that size 11, by the way? That it's gag.
Pretty good.
That was amazing. I was like, oh, they're both just giving him, oh no, they're saying size 11.
They, or were they just flipping him off, and that's something that Mike came up on with because he's quick-witted?
Because he didn't want this to blow up? Maybe.
Are the Kitchen Brothers actually mute, or they just don't talk? Because didn't one of them whisper something into his ear in this episode?
Yeah, I don't know if they're mute. I don't remember them whispering, but I don't necessarily think they're mute either.
I do think they're also still slightly goofy. Like, I haven't warmed up to... They need to slide someone into a hole in an ice lake for me to take him seriously as badasses. Although Mike is doing enough to kind of carry them. Like, Mike is a scary guy, and these are kind of his enforcers. Yeah. Uh-huh. So
how bad are they?
Yeah. There's a little bit of that kind of carrying over, but just... And I guess that's a very Fargo thing, too. Like, ruthless, scary people that look kind of pedestrian and maybe even dumb.
Yeah. Yeah, but going back to this scene at the end with Lou, I thought, you know, Jesse Plemons does a hell of a job here just with this forced smile that he's got this whole time. Mm-hmm. And he plays it way cooler than I thought he could have. Like, I don't think Lester at the beginning of last season plays it nearly this cool.
I thought that's what we were going to. We were heading to Lester Town. But yeah. There's a couple of things, but here I think his slightly slow reputation probably helps him out because Lou's thinking, oh, well, I just got this guy in a double shift, and you know,
he's
I might have scooped him a bit.
Uh-huh.
He's always been kind of slow. So I was going to ask you, does Lou suspect a thing?
I don't think so. No.
Do you think Lou will suspect something in retrospect, though? Like he'll
see something else that makes him think, you know, Jesse
was a little off.
Jesse
that
Plemons
night.
Is acting a little weird. Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe so.
Yeah.
Maybe so.
And what is so?
But I mean, the sausage thing immediately made me think of the wood chipper in Fargo, right?
Yeah. I know, like, a guy on the forums had a problem with being able to successfully grind an entire human leg.
What?
Yeah.
He has had problems with this in the past? Or
No.
He just found this incredulous?
He found it hard to believe that you could grind up human body, bones, and all. And when I think about it, I'm like, okay, I believe an industrial, commercial-grade meat grinder could probably do that.
Yeah.
It might clog the, you know, it's like, I don't know why you got the ground beef filter on it. You know, you could just like take that like grate off and just have it grind out and do whatever with it. Yeah. And also, I'm not sure exactly what he's going to do with all this human remains. Like, surely the god not going to sell it.
Please, please don't sell this. I could see a scenario in which next episode he finishes just as his boss comes in and says, oh, you did some good early grinding, huh? Let's take this stuff out for sale. Like, there could be some fucked up stuff going on next episode.
Well, I got something to talk about him as in relation with his boss, but I actually went back and watched that scene again after I was talking to this guy on the forum, and I think that there's, like, bits of white and gristle and stuff. Like, I do think they're suggesting, yes, the entire body, bones and all, are being ground successfully, and I don't know if that's possible or not, but that's what Fargo is positing, so.
I mean, are we not, like, I really see this next episode going badly here.
Well, so here's the thing.
Because the scenario they've set up, right, is he took a day off work.
Uh-huh.
You can see him saying, getting caught kind of in the act, like right after it's over.
Uh-huh.
His boss comes in, says, oh, thanks for grinding this up. He's like, yeah, I wanted to come in early to make up for yesterday's absence. And he can't say anything about this meat. And I don't know. Things could go real bad.
So here's the thing. I don't know if the time works out because it was only like, not even quite 11 o'clock when Lou stopped by.
But he was nowhere near done.
Oh, see, I thought he was. Like, it looked like he had an arm and a head left.
I thought he still had a torso to go. Like, how do you grind up a pelvis? Like, the pelvic bone is going to take some fucking grinding, man.
But there again,
the skull is going to take some grinding.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Like, I don't think he can grind a skull. Right? There's just too much hair and teeth and shit.
I would think so. Is he going to take the head with him?
I don't know. Like, I honestly don't know. And that's probably a very Fargo possibility that they're going to unwittingly sell some of Rye.
I have a bad feeling that that's going to happen.
Wow. What did you think about when Peggy comes into the butcher shop and essentially tells, is it Bud?
Whatever his boss's name is.
Bud's
yeah.
Meats. He tells Bud that he's you know, he overdid it with the oysters or clams, which is another, you know, don't trust anything in the sea. There's another seafood reference in relation to crime and bad things happening. He looked at her kind of skeptically as she walks out the door. And we know in the last episode that he seems like he thinks a lot of Ed. Do you think that this is going to be like, Ed never calls in sick and this is kind of weird and that it's going to make him come in a little early or...
Maybe so.
So I think he's going to get finished 2-3 o'clock in the morning, come in to work next day. And
so you think this is good? This is done.
He's
gotten away with it.
No, he's going to do something stupid. Like there'll be a pound or two of that ground beef. Cause I'm assuming he's going to package all this up and then like put it in his truck and then go dump it somewhere. So if he ever gets stopped, it's like, yeah, my buddy wanted, cause that happens, right? Your buddy shoots a deer and you're going to do him a solid. You're going to, you know, dress it up and all that stuff. And so, you know, that's an airtight thing. And then he gets the place.
Perfect story.
It.
We hit the deer.
Yeah, sure.
Might as well not waste it. Grind it up, make it into some sausage.
Yeah.
He's got a story there ready to be told, but I don't know that he's smart enough to tell it.
But there's something, frankly. There's already some kind of skepticism in his boss, I thought, that surprised me from as much as they seem to get along. The fact that he was wanting to sell this company to him. Maybe this is putting some doubt or he's just going to sit down and have, hey, I need to have a talk with you. I don't know if that's...
Yeah, I'm with you. So I think he was surprised.
Right.
That.
But I do also like the fact that they're going to sell some rye. You can have some rye on rye.
Oh.
A Frisco rye sandwich.
I guess we should talk about Peggy, yeah?
Yeah, let's talk about Peggy. She's gotten wrapped up in a seminar seductress situation.
Yeah, and she's stealing toilet paper, and like, there's a lot of stuff going on with Peggy. First of all, there's a Rock County bus that's taking people to work in the morning.
I said the same
what
thing.
What the fuck? That's the most.
I've lived in big cities that have fucked up public transportation, and this goddamn place has got a functional bus route.
I don't buy it.
Nah.
I don't buy it for a second.
Nah. No.
I mean, he should have just taken her in his truck.
Yeah, if you got mass transport anywhere outside the Twin City region,
yeah.
I don't believe it. Like, you can tell me in 2015, you can send me pictures of the bus, and I'm not going to believe you.
Yeah.
I'm not.
My notes say that this is the least believable part of the episode.
Yeah.
And I firmly believe that.
Like, I'll believe aliens destroying police cars before I believe that you're going to get some functional transportation system in Fargo, North Dakota.
Yep.
Or Laverne, Minnesota, which, take your pick.
But yeah, there's clearly something going on. Her boss wants her to go to this seminar. She's kind of pushing her forward on, I don't know if it's necessarily that she wants her to succeed in her dreams, or she wants her to
she's
get
recruiting
better than Ed.
She's no,
and
no,
leave Ed.
She's recruiting for the other team is what she's doing.
Yeah. I mean, it becomes apparent throughout the episode that that's what she's into.
Yeah.
I don't know where Peggy stands on that, because she shies away from it, but I don't know that she shies away because it's offensive to her, or if she's just uncomfortable in general.
See, I got she's barking up the wrong tree.
You think so?
Yeah. Okay. I think Peggy does not want to be with Ed for the rest of her life and thinks she can do a lot better.
Certainly, yeah.
And wants to actualize herself in that direction, but I don't think that he means she's going to actualize herself in the way of Toilet Paper Woman's direction.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. And that's going to be... It wouldn't surprise me if she ends up having to murder her.
Maybe so.
Because, again, it's like,
she knows
that's crazy,
up.
But this is Fargo, and that'd be a very Fargo thing to do.
Yeah, and you clearly get the impression that she knows that something is up here.
Yeah.
Peggy's not telling her the whole truth about this windshield, and
going on. And so many people are seeing so many bullshit versions of this story, it's going to catch up to them.
But yeah.
That she does feel like the season two Lester Nygaard, though, that she's going to get a taste for this kind of thing, and then... Hey, this solves all life's problems. Can you grind me? I got this woman hit on me, Ed. Can you grind her up too?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Poor Ed.
So I don't know where Peggy's headed right now, but it seems clear that she's not satisfied in her current life. She doesn't know what direction to take to get out of it.
Well, plus having someone over to your house when you've got a murder car parked in your garage that you don't even know if your husband successfully cleaned. Like, I get it that she needed a ride home because I guess the bus is only one way. It'll take you in, won't take you out.
But even that seems dumb. Like, I don't want anyone near my house.
Yeah, like, if you can't come in. It's my husband's puking clam guts all over the place. You cannot go inside yet.
Or just like, hey, Ed, come pick me up from work today.
But they only got the one fucked up car, right?
No, he's got a truck.
Oh, yeah.
That he sits in, so
But I guess he had to get the busy grinding the meats.
When did she get off work?
I don't know, because Ed also did a lot of... Ed did a lot of hard staring at his wife getting in the car with the seminar seductress as well. So maybe Ed's the one that's going to end up killing her.
But I don't
know. In a fit of some kind of misplaced jealousy.
Could be.
But I do think she's going to die.
All right.
What do you think of something I picked up on Alan Sepinwall's review? Lou tie and knots. I guess the old Lou, that's something that he did as kind of a nervous habit, or not a nervous habit, or like a pondering thing. Like, he was always in the coffee diner doing knots when there weren't customers.
I don't remember
that
noticing
too,
that, yeah.
But I do feel like Patrick Wilson, that's the guy's name, right?
Yeah.
He doesn't have a lot of physical resemblance to Mr. Carradine. But he does seem to have adopted a lot of the mannerisms in the same way that Ewan McGregor aped Alec McGuinness's mannerisms enough that even though they didn't look a lot the same, it's like, yes, that's obviously a young... I feel like he's really crushing the young Lou aspect.
I think so.
and just his, you know, his manner. What else do we want to talk about? I want to talk about Lou's wife.
Okay.
Which Betsy is her name.
Yeah, she's getting some cancer treatment.
She's getting chemo, and yeah, and Lou knows this, and he's got a free lunch because his Fargo situation's gotten all, you know, he's it's now being taken over from Local Matter, and there's some chain of command BS. But he goes in like to a fugue state as soon as he sees the Waffle Hut, and kind of ignores his family. And it sends him out to play in the snow. And I thought that they were showing Betsy in a lot of obvious physical distress. Like, she's game, and she's, you know, going to go out and make the best of the situation. But she really shouldn't be doing this in her condition. I wonder if there's going to be some kind of tragedy there where, you know,
could be.
Lou's being wrapped up in his casework ends up, you know, being detrimental to her health. And what's that going to mean to Molly? And, I mean, her Molly and him seem solid in future Fargo.
Yeah.
So it can't be something that's like just a complete disaster.
You killed Mom.
Yeah.
There's not going to be any of that. Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't know, man. She seemed like she was in really rough shape when she stood up too fast after finding the gun.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. I another thing I want to talk about in that scene when she finds the gun, he's inside and he's examining the
bug
crime
spray.
Scene.
Sure.
This bug spray, I love how it's set up. Like it's another condiment, right? And I feel like that's Fargo, right? There's poison mixed in with the rest of it.
Sure.
And it, you might not notice it right away. It's just adding a hint of flavor, but it's there.
Uh-huh.
And it's killing everything. So in that scene, they see Mike drive by in his car, right?
Yep.
And, you know, they stop him later on down the road. But you notice that Joe Bulow is gone. He was in the car before. Now he's gone. Where do you think he went?
Slid into an ice hole.
I highly doubt it. He's camped out somewhere in town, right? He's got
to
be.
Or maybe he went back and these guys are... Because their whole mission is to find Rye now.
Yeah.
And Big Joe...
Well, this is the car they rode in on. So, I mean, maybe they dropped him off at like an airport or something, but...
He took the bus.
He took... Yeah.
The magic bus that just takes you wherever you need to go.
Uh-huh. I thought it was curious that he was absent in this.
You know, car. I didn't even pick up on that.
I don't know where he is.
I didn't
pick
up as the same car. I didn't like, yeah, I didn't pick up on any of that stuff.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, okay. I don't know where he's at.
We'll find out, I'm sure.
So Dodd, this is something we talked about at the beginning. I forgot to bring it up. Dodd sidles up to Indian Joe and says, "Are you with me?"
Yeah.
Is Indian Joe with him?
I think so.
Indian Joe seems smart to me, and backing Dodd's not the smart play. Like, it would be kind of Fargo-esque for him to be in the mama's back pocket the whole time, and Dodd is just,
there's a question of loyalty versus intelligence, right? Those are two things that I feel like in this universe with this character are at odds.
Who does he feel more loyal to? Wouldn't he feel like, I guess he works with Dodd closely, but, you know, this is the old man's widow who's formidable in herself, and he's got to know that.
Yeah, there's something about the way he says, like, when she says, "Give us the room," and he's like, "Not you," and Indian Joe stays. There's something about that that tells me he's more loyal to Dodd than he is to
But here's the other
family.
Thing I think is interesting is... Yeah. The one thing we see him doing for Dodd is the exact same thing that his mother wanted, which is find Rye. So I'm going to be looking very closely to see Indian Joe acting in direct disobedience or directly against, Mama Gerhardt's orders.
Yeah.
Because I kind of suspect that he's in her pocket.
Okay.
And that, like, she's...
I'm not entirely sure.
Several steps ahead of Dodd. And that doesn't mean that she'll win, because Dodd could just do some shocking act of familial violence that blows the...
Sure.
That she's not willing to do that blows the roof off of this thing, much like so many oysters and clams. But...
Yeah, that ambition versus loyalty is also an interesting one, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
There could be some bad stuff to go down in this family.
And I also, like, how committed is Dodd to this course? Would he kill his brother?
I don't know.
Like, the brothers, they seem like they've got some, but that's, you know, it's hard to tell with brothers. Like, you can have a lot of rivalry going on, but you're not going to kill your fucking brother.
Sure.
Yeah. Like, Peyton Manning and Eli, I don't think, ever seriously almost murdered each other, even though they've got quite the rivalry in the family, from all accounts.
Uh-huh.
So, I don't know. That's something I'm going to be watching closely.
So I'm confused about the name of this episode.
Oh, yes.
We need to talk about this because it's kind of the elephant in the room. Before the Law. Before the Law is a short story written by Frank Kafka.
That's part of a larger story.
Oh, is it?
I think it's like in the middle of this story he's telling, he puts his parable.
I don't know anything about the larger story.
Okay, I did a little bit more I was okay. In the midst of my research when you came in to read that. Yeah.
Okay, so the story in its essence is about a man who is trying to gain access to the law, which in the version of the story I read is not capitalized, so it's not a proper noun, it's not a thing. I don't know what the law is in this story, but it's a man who wants to gain access to the law. There's a gatekeeper keeping him out. He says, not only am I a gatekeeper, but I'm the weaker of the three gatekeepers.
He's already an imposing looking man. Like he's described as kind of like this dark, dangerous looking guy in a long coat. And, you know,
he's intimidating looking. Yeah. And so you see him and he says to the man, there are two others in there. The third one, of which I can't even look at.
He's so fucking scary.
Because he's so fucking scary. And so this man is denied permission to go inside. He decides, well, I need permission because these guys are
so scary.
But the
door's wide open.
The gate's wide open, yeah. So he posts up. He sits outside this gate for his entire life. And during the course of his life, he's trying to bribe the gatekeeper to let him in.
Cajole him.
Yeah, tell him stories, all this stuff, to try and get inside the law. And he eventually never does. Mm-hmm. At the end of it, the man has one question. He says, why has no one else ever tried to gain access to the law?
Yeah, why am I the only one that showed up this whole time?
And the gatekeeper tells him, because this is your entrance.
This is only for you, and you're about to die. As soon as you do, I'm closing it up forever.
I'm puzzled by this story, man. So I can see a couple of things that I can try and read into where... Uh-huh. There's this kind of, you know, nothing ventured, nothing gained sort of thing where the man never even tried to get inside because of the intimidation. He didn't know if there were, in fact, two more gatekeepers inside.
Sure.
Maybe there's a little bit of that.
There's also one of the key things is when the guy tries to bribe the guard, the gatekeeper takes his bribes, but he says, I'm only taking this so you don't feel like a failure.
Yeah.
There's a couple ways maybe that ties in. Like, for example, when Mike is talking to Sheriff Larson, there's a little bit of that where I'm letting you hassle me and question me so you don't feel like you're a shitty policeman. But you and I both know that we could draw and put holes in you and leave you in this abandoned highway or this lonely abandoned road. I mean, because that was the menacing thing. Like, isn't it amazing that these two guys in this world of madness can talk on this long, deserted stretch of road calmly and rashly? That's the implication is I could kill you and never be discovered, never be caught.
Yeah. If this wasn't calm and rational, it would go badly for you.
Yeah. The reason why you have nothing to fear from us is because we have nothing to fear from you. You've got nothing on us.
Yeah.
And so maybe Mike is the first gatekeeper, which implies, is there two other scarier gatekeepers, or is this Kansas City thing a charade where he is the big bad, and if you can get past him, then it's game over?
There's nothing stopping you, yeah. The other way you could read this is kind of from Ed's perspective, where he is essentially toiling away his entire life with only, or I guess not even Ed's perspective, like Peggy's perspective, like, She knows there's something greater out there, the law, whatever that is. And it is only fear that keeps her from accessing it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if she could just simply walk through this gate, past this gatekeeper, maybe an entire world would be open to her. But it's kind of that futile toiling away for nothing over the course of your entire life because you're too scared to do anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just kind of set and locked in your ways.
I think it will also apply to Ed in the same way that he...
I think so, yeah.
He knows he should do something, and it's within his power to do it, but he doesn't do it because of this hold that Peggy has on him.
Yeah.
So she's effectively, I guess, the gatekeeper for him.
I suppose
his life. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't even understand, like, none of these dreams that she has are his dreams, although I guess, I mean, does Ed really want to buy the butcher shop? I see a lot of people. You see a lot of people do that. Like, they're in a job that they don't. It's not a job that they chose. It's, you know, maybe they got in the first thing they did out of college and like, I'm going to move on. But then you get a promotion and another promotion and mm-hmm. it's like, oh, man.
And it's
like,
a clear path.
It's like there's like the sunk cost fallacy writ large. Like, well, man, if I go and try to do the thing that I've always wanted to do, then I'm going to start all over. And that's a scary, as you know, you and I both know, that's a scary thing.
Sure.
A lot of sober reflection to do something like that. I don't know. I honestly don't feel like I'm smart enough to get all of the cultural references in a way that like True Detective pitches it pretty high with snooty references to Nishi and all that stuff. But it's always like fairly in your face, the connection. Mm-hmm. As much as I love that show, like you don't have to dig very deep to find why this quote is there or why this title is there. Whereas like last year, you could think about like what did Burden's ass mean in relation to Key and Peele?
Yeah.
And, you know, Lorne and all that stuff, or you could meditate on that for hours and not know exactly what it meant.
Yeah, they always just hint at themes in this show.
And you don't need any of that information to enjoy the show.
Absolutely.
Or even to enjoy it on the next level, because sometimes I wonder if this is just a more refined version of what Nick Pizzolatto does on True Detective, where it's like, yes, these are there for if you took these courses in college or if well read, you enjoy it, you can think about it, and it enhances it, and it kind of gives it's another part, just like the music is a part, and the cinematography and the gorgeous composition of the shots are, you don't need that to enjoy the main story, but it's this all goes into the stew that makes the show great. And even on a subconscious, you know, a pretentious title like Before the Law, gives you a certain mindset. Hell, most people watching Fargo probably don't even pay attention to what the episodes are called.
Yeah. I mean, if I'm watching this on cable, I don't know and I don't care.
Right.
So it's good that it works without it.
Yeah. But no, I do feel like this is one of the shows where even when I understand the references and I've researched the references and I'm familiar and I got a good grasp material, I still don't know quite what they're getting at, but I don't think it's nothing.
But the thing that I like about it is it encourages this conversation and it encourages you to kind of think about this show thematically in a way that a lot of other shows you don't.
Yeah. But I keep thinking about the Anne's email last week where she just deconstructed beautifully the whole theater of the absurd.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And how, as weird, is that something me and Seth, we were chuckling back and forth as we were watching it the other night, is like, yep, theater of the absurd. Like, yeah, Fargo embodies that.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of feeling. So it's like next week I think we got a Kierkegaard reference, and what Anne said about that kind of blew my mind about the fact that Abraham embracing the absurdity of asking for your sons to be killed and just like, okay, whatever, I go along with it, is key to getting his son back.
Sure.
Like in giving in and embracing the illogical is sometimes the only way to proceed. And I wonder how that's going to tie into like Ed and Peggy's story and the war between Fargo and Kansas City. It's super interesting.
I think so.
And shows, again, gorgeous to look at.
So I think next episode is called The Myth of Sisyphus. Is that right?
Ah, okay. You might be right. I know that's one of them.
it is one of them. And I feel like that might, like now that we kind of know that everyone's set on finding Rye, I could totally see that being the crux of the episode.
Uh-huh.
Like, obviously they can't find him. Yeah. It's a futile task. It's endless.
Sure.
There's no trace of him left. So,
or it could be
good luck.
It could be Ed trying to get back to a normal life too.
That too. Yeah. It could be multiple things, you know?
And it could be that you have to keep watching to see how it pans out.
Maybe so.
So,
anything else?
We'll probably talk for 10-15 minutes on it and have no good answers for you next week, so you got that to look forward to. Oh, the other thing, the Mars shot I talked about with Ted Danson, I'm going to put in the show notes. The UFO story, 1979 UFO involving a Minnesota sheriff's car, I'm going to put in the show notes. And also, okay, Peggy's crime is based on a real event. Some woman in 2001 struck a homeless man. He embedded himself in his windshield. She drove him home, and he died over the course of a day or two in her garage.
I want to say I heard about this.
About this too. And then I saw this on Reddit and I looked at it and got familiar. I didn't know what ended up happening, but she got sentenced to 50 years in jail for
Christ.
For her role in this.
Involuntary manslaughter or for the aftermath?
I don't think she would have gotten shit if she just ran, because this guy apparently was drunk and stepped out in front of her. But the fact that you drove home with a guy in your car, wounded, still alive, and then just left him in the garage for 2 days and tried to cover, that's where you get fucked.
Yeah.
It's like, who does that? But I'm going to put all those things in the show notes if you want to read more. And what the hell, also link to the Before the Law short story if you want to meditate over that and drive yourself crazy.
Okay.
Jill, first up, feedback. You questioned the filming location of Fargo, and I wanted to mention that Fargo is filmed in my home city, Calgary, in Alberta, Canada. I know that the production was done here and that filming also included smaller towns an hour's drive south of our city. However, in watching this episode, I was amazed to see so many local landmarks. It's amazing how dressing a scene can really make it look like it's from a different time and place. Calgary is a large, urban, modern city with a population of over 1 million, but all the filming is done in areas that would be considered quaint neighborhoods with historically protected buildings, therefore giving it a small-town vintage look. Hmm. Thank God for the historical preservation societies, or else how would we have these period shows?
I don't know.
Small-town America, USA.
They'd all be stage sets, whatever.
I was most surprised to see the house that Lou lives in is located just around the corner from my own. I have attached a couple pictures of the house and the notification of filming that was up in March, which means if you could have walked around a house and maybe gotten into the episode. Because I learned from Vince Gilligan on the Breaking Bad Insider podcast that they do that. When they put up those notice filming in this location, it's so if they accidentally catch you in the background that they don't have to get your release or permission to put you in the episode. Our community is standard residential, built in the 60s. The style of that particular house does stand out compared to most of the typical bungalows that surround it. But yeah, I guess there's a lot. She talked about there's a lot of filming going on in Calgary. That's currently Hell on Wheels is filmed there. Brokeback Mountain was filmed around because the Rockies go up into the Canada, the Canadian Rockies.
We don't have a monopoly on the Rockies.
We don't. We might have to invade or something, because that's a strategic natural resource.
The high ground.
You can't cede the high ground to Canada.
Hell no.
God knows what they'll do with it. Those maple loving bastards. But thanks for that background information. I enjoy that. We actually had in Cincinnati, in our fair city, Bruce Willis is filming something.
Yeah.
Did you ever get in on that? Because I know you were kind of interested in trying to be an extra for it.
Yeah, they were doing an extra call, and I
have to drive downtown and stand in a
parking
line.
And
there's a burrito across the street I need to eat. Michael S. said, Ted Danson's determined fright during the confrontation with the Kansas City gangsters was palpable. Mm-hmm. Do you think that this can be better than season one?
Man, we're two episodes
Is that an interesting debate? The fact that we're having someone bringing up the debate in the second episode kind of implies that, of course, it can be better than season one.
Could it be? Okay, so is a different question from could it be?
Sure.
Could it be? Sure.
And I'll even go so far as to say that I don't know that I considered Fargo one of the best things on television until it was over, because there's always the possibility that they'll fuck it up.
Yeah.
It's easy
and
to tell.
And that's why I don't want to say, is it?
It's really easy to tell an interesting, involved story with lots of mysteries. And that can you tie that up in a satisfying way that doesn't have your audience saying, what the fuck?
Yeah.
That said, that I don't have any doubts in this show. I think this season looks better. Like, and not like better in a concrete way, but I think just making it
stylistically vintage. Yeah,
having a period piece automatically just raises a difficulty, and I think that in the back of my mind is making me say this is better, or like I don't see, you know, stuff like I'm seeing in the Salverson home and the decoration and the attention to detail and how the cars look. I automatically think that looks cooler.
Yeah,
so it's got potential for sure.
It feels a little bit more like the movie Fargo too.
A little bit.
And kind of
I know what you're saying.
I know Fargo's kind of set between these two shows, but
right.
I the cars feel a little more Fargo-esque. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's Fargo was in... Well, it wasn't a period piece at the time, right?
I don't know. I think it might have been slightly less than
but when you watch it today, it feels like a period piece because it's set, you know, the setting, and we're 20 years from
that. I want to say it was in the 80s.
I thought it was in the early 90s, and that Fargo came out in the mid to late 90s.
Maybe it was, and it just takes the Midwest a while to catch up.
Well, that's the other thing. We're always kind of a decade behind the coasts in how our buildings look.
Fashion, and architecture,
Dan from Manchester says, quick observation. Every time Lester had an evil idea or transformation in season one, there was a musical cue of like a Christmas-esque bell sound. This musical cue could be heard when Peggy hit Rye last episode when we saw her reaction. Hmm. And this one is particularly interesting when Fat Damon hit her in the eye by mistake post-murder. Is that a signal that she will definitely be in this or this season's Lester? I think that she will be using the bruised face to get away with her involvement in the murder, possibly saying that he beat her as she tried to stop him murdering Rye.
Yeah, she totally set him up this episode.
Yeah.
Like, oh, yeah, Ed got in a scuffle and...
Uh-huh.
Or kerfluffle, whatever it
and
is.
And she showed her face in public that had the bruise.
Yeah.
He stayed away. Yeah. He concludes by saying, I think we'll see her stop at nothing to get to her new life in California. Yeah, man, yeah. I didn't make that connection, but that's I could totally see her panicking and, you know, sobbing and telling the story to the police. And
oh, yeah.
Who would have thought that Ed had it in him, eh? Shocking.
Sure.
Barry C., not sure where this is coming from, but do you see an Emmy-deserving performance coming from Ted Danson by the time the series finishes? The scene where he stops Mike and the brothers showed a subtle fear and vulnerability that, in my opinion, was hard to pull off. It seems he may fill a similar role to Lou in the previous season, a role which I very much enjoyed. I think that if this keeps up, we're probably going to see Fargo get a lot of Emmys. Because
both on the cast and crew side, I think.
And I don't know how you honestly, like, yes, what Ted Danson's doing is an amazing and outside what I would consider his performance envelope.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, did we talk about this on the podcast or before? Like, it might have been during lunch where Ted Danson in the twilight of his life, let alone career, steps out of the Cheers box and
steps out of the Becker box
and Becker box and does this. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Who the fuck calls Ted Danson? I got the perfect part for you. It's a small town Minnesota sheriff and you're going to but Jesse Plemons is knocking out of the park.
Yeah.
Patrick Kirsten Wilson.
Dunst, like everybody is.
Everyone. I don't know what her name is, but Betsy, you know, Molly's mom is doing really interesting work.
Yeah.
Mama Gerhardt, like everyone's doing really quality, punching way above the weight. Bear, the guy from fucking Mule.
Angus Sampson, sure.
Damn.
That's a fucking awesome name, by the way.
Angus Sampson. That is. That sounds like the new sandwich coming out of Hardee's and Carl's Jr.
It totally does.
100% Angus Sampson. It's enough to kill a Philistine.
100% rye.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it didn't do too badly in the Emmys last year, but I could see it getting a lot. But yeah. The Emmys is kind of a crapshoot, too. Yeah. Having said that, this show with its big, splashy individual scene performances, like I feel that it's kind of stacking the deck to win Emmys because you could submit an episode like this one for Ted Danson and like, yeah, okay, that's awesome. You don't need to know anything else about the characters because we don't other than what we're seeing on the screen. And it's amazing.
You know what other show is doing those hyper-focused character moments and knocking it out of the fucking park?
Would that be
park?
The Leftovers?
Yes. It's going to be heavy competition.
Yeah.
The Leftovers I could also see just sweeping.
Yeah. I saw some chatter on our forum about maybe Melissa McBride finally getting an Emmy nod on
no,
Walking Dead.
Come
I'm
on. Like, don't get her hopes up.
She's doing really good work, but really, when you look at what's on right now,
yeah.
Walking Dead has never been better than it is, and it's getting blown off the stage by Fargo and The Leftovers. They're amazing.
Take nothing away from Melissa, but
no, she's doing really good work on a solid show. Walking Dead is not... I'm not being ironic. I'm getting pure pleasure from The Walking Dead right now.
Yeah.
But this stuff is on a other level. Other level.
Yep.
That's all we got for feedback. You can send more to fargo@baldmove.com or get on our forums.baldmove.com to discuss it with our fellow fans and Jim and I.
All right.
I'm super excited for next week.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll be back with another podcast on Wednesday of next week. Until then, I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron. See ya.